KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, how does Ukraine stand on the battlefield against Russia? Then strong reaction in the U.K. to Vice President Vance's remark about some random country. Also, what doctors have learned about long-term COVID. And later, Selma, Alabama, 60 years after civil rights marchers were beaten on Bloody Sunday. Mark Miles says Selma should be a model for harmony and progress today, but...
It just feel like we're going back into the 60s. So it kind of reminds me of what our forefathers fought for and the sacrifices they made.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, March 8, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump is urging Congress to pass a bill regarding cryptocurrency by August. The president and members of his family have considerable financial stakes in the digital asset. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports the president's call is part of a recent push from the White House to focus on cryptocurrency.
President Trump hosted crypto business leaders at the White House for the first ever summit on digital assets.
This is a tremendous opportunity for economic growth and innovation in our financial sector, and will really go a long way. I think it's going to be a tremendous We feel like pioneers in a way.
The event was held the day after Trump signed an executive order that established a strategic Bitcoin reserve, which is seeded by 200,000 Bitcoin forfeited to the government in various court proceedings. It also directs the Treasury, among others, to come up with plans to acquire more digital currency. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell attended a monetary policy forum yesterday. He said, overall, the U.S. economy is doing well.
Despite elevated levels of uncertainty, the U.S. economy continues to be in a good place. The labor market is solid, and inflation has moved closer to our 2% longer-run goal. At the Fed, we are intently focused on our dual-mandate goals given to us by Congress, maximum employment, and stable prices.
But Powell said the new administration has made significant policy changes, such as in trade, and it's uncertain how those changes will affect the economy. The Trump administration says it's ending collective bargaining for thousands of workers at the Transportation Security Administration. NPR's Joel Rose reports the agency's union is calling the move an attack on workers' rights.
The Department of Homeland Security says it's eliminating the collective bargaining agreement for 47,000 TSA officers who are responsible for protecting the U.S. aviation system. In a statement, DHS said that agreement was hindering the TSA's mission of keeping Americans safe and accused the TSA's union of protecting poor performers and devoting too many hours to union work. In response, the union called DHS's claims completely fabricated and promised to push back on what it called an unprovoked attack. The Biden administration reached a deal last year with the TSA union to expand workers' rights and raise pay, which top Democrats say has helped to lower the agency's high attrition rate. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Ukrainian officials say at least 14 people were killed in Russian aerial attacks overnight. It was the second night of heavy Russian bombardment since the U.S. stopped sharing satellite images with Ukraine, significantly reducing its ability to defend itself. The U.S. suspension of intelligence sharing is designed to pressure Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a peace proposal devised by the Trump administration. This is NPR News in Washington. Millions of residents of Southeast Australia are being urged to stay indoors as former Cyclone Alfred continues to pelt the region with strong winds and heavy rain. Officials say one man died in flooding in New South Wales. South Korea's impeached president has returned to the presidential residence from jail after a court canceled his detention. NPR's Siwoong Gong reports from Seoul.
President Yoon Suk-yeol left Seoul Detention Center in a motorcade 52 days after he was arrested over insurrection charges. A court in Seoul ruled on Friday that his detention was invalid because of procedural flaws. Prosecutors decided not to appeal the decision. Saturday, Yoon stepped out of his car before he left the detention center. he waved to his supporters gathered near an entrance and clenched his fist. He will still stand trial on criminal charges for disrupting South Korea's constitutional order. Separately, the Constitutional Court is expected to rule on his impeachment soon and decide whether he should be removed from office. Seo Eun-kwong, NPR News, Seoul.
Swiss police say they've solved a dog napping. A man returned to his home near Zurich to find his two Blanca dogs gone and a note demanding a ransom of more than $1 million. He called the police, who arrested a Norwegian man at the airport. After further leads, police in Poland detained another suspect and found the dogs, who were returned home to its owners yesterday. A Blanca is a toy breed of Russian dogs and can sell for thousands of dollars. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Ukraine is under new pressure now, 3 years after resisting Russia's invasion. Russia has stepped up missile and drone attacks that have killed Ukrainians and damaged homes and energy infrastructure. The U.S. has suspended military aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine. And yesterday, President Donald Trump said,
I find that in terms of getting a final settlement, it may be easier dealing with Russia, which is surprising because they have all the cards. I mean, they're bombing the hell out of them right now.
Phillips O'Brien is professor of strategic studies at St. Andrews University in Scotland. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
What is the state of the conflict on the battlefield now as you read it?
Well, actually, it had been very stable for the last few months. That Russian advances had really almost stopped completely. And the Ukrainians had taken a very heavy toll on the Russians. The Russian losses were actually heavy and the Russians could maintain and go forward. The question we face now, of course, is with the U.S. basically siding with Putin. It's not like they've just withdrawn from Ukraine, that they've withdrawn in such a way to provide a significant military advantage to the Russians. What we don't know is how significant that advantage will be and whether that will change what's happening on the battlefield.
What about the role of Europe? Can Europe step into that void as they have pledged to do?
They better. I mean, they should have done more to now in the sense that they should have planned on a Trump presidency and a Trump presidency resulting in the U.S. switching sides to support Putin. They didn't. They didn't believe it was possible. Maybe they didn't want to believe it was possible. There is now, I think, a greater understanding of the actual reality of the U.S.'s position and its support of Putin. And so the Europeans are desperately trying to pay some kind of catch-up. They do have resources. They're much, much richer than the Russians, but they wasted the time they should have had getting ready for this.
You have been a critic of the way the U.S. has handled the war,
yep.
Under President Trump most recently, but also under President Biden.
Yep.
Where do you believe the United States has been falling short?
Well, basically, the United States has had two presidencies that have been part of this war. The first one, the Biden administration didn't want Ukraine to win. And the second one, the Trump administration wants Russia to win. So the United States at no point has actually wanted Ukraine to win this war. So the Biden administration funded Ukraine simply not to win, but not to lose. And the Trump administration is taking active steps to help the Russians win. So at no point has the United States actually wanted a democratic Ukraine to win this war.
I come back to the fact that you have said very openly the United States is now on Russia's side.
Yeah.
What about, don't even wrong refer them as President Trump's protestations, but his insistence that the whole idea is to get a deal.
Well, how come all the concessions are being forced on Ukraine? I mean, all the penalties, Russia has been given no extra pressure by Trump. I mean, he talks about, oh, maybe we'll put on sanctions. All the pressure is being put on Ukraine. The aid has been slashed, cut loose. The intelligence has been cut. They're not even sending medical supplies from what we can hear. So if this is to try and get a deal, why is all the extreme pressure being placed on Ukraine? And Russia indeed is getting, you know, bouquets and compliments from Trump in the clip you just played. It seems to me that it is a very one-sided way of doing business.
But if there is a deal, won't that end a lot of suffering for Ukraine?
Well, it depends what the deal is. I mean, the deal, if it's a temporary ceasefire and just allows Russia to rebuild and come back in Ukraine in a year, will just make it worse. So,
and you believe that would be a you believe that would be a Russian aim?
I think that's what Trump wants. Yeah, I think that's what Trump and Putin are working out. You freeze the conflict. You give Ukraine no real security guarantees. So you won't have any NATO troops in Ukraine to defend it. And you give Russia time to rebuild, then all the sanctions will be ended on Russia by the U.S. And in a year or two, Russia will rebuild its military.
Phillips O'Brien, his book about World War II is The Strategist. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The United States and Britain call their alliance the special relationship. But as NPR's Lauren Frayer reports, it was tested this week by some comments made by America's vice president.
We now come to Prime Minister's questions.
When Prime Minister Keir Starmer opened his weekly PMQs, Prime Minister's Questions, in Parliament this week, he started with a tribute to a group of British soldiers killed in Afghanistan.
Sergeant Nigel Coop was 33.
It was solemn, but unexpected, given those deaths were 13 years ago.
We will never forget their bravery and their sacrifice. And I know the whole House will join in me in remembering them and all those who serve our country.
But the Prime Minister may have felt the need to highlight the sacrifices of British troops at war after hearing Vice President Vance say this on Fox News days earlier.
The very best security guarantee is to give Americans economic upside in the future of Ukraine. That is a way better security guarantee than 20,000 troops from some random country that hasn't fought a war in 30 or 40 years.
Now, Vance did not specify which random country he's talking about, but France and the UK are the only countries that have pledged to send peacekeepers to Ukraine, and Brits are angry.
Wow. A vice president who is as dumb as he's aggressive.
Profound ignorance, his insecurity, his silliness.
Don't you dare insult our troops.
That was radio host Nick Ferrari, former MP Rory Stewart, and political journalist Julia Hartley Brewer. Just a smattering of the social media videos we're able to play on the radio. Lots have been more profane. Vance hit a particular nerve with fellow veterans.
I've come under fire in Kosovo. I know what war is. I've come under fire in Iraq. I know what war is.
General Sir Richard Sheriff is a former UK Army officer and NATO official. He calls Vance's comments deeply insulting.
To a country that has stood alongside America through absolutely thick and thin, and he needs to read history and remember history.
After Vance's comments went viral, he wrote on social media that France and the UK have fought bravely alongside the US. But for many here, the feeling of being insulted by a close ally has exacerbated another feeling, that America is no longer the ally it used to be. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
You will often hear us report on this program about the unemployment rate, consumer prices, whether the U.S. economy is growing or shrinking. We put a lot of faith in those statistics, and they typically come from the federal government. Will they remain reliable, given budget and staffing cuts, or what observers fear would be deliberate meddling? And Pierre Scott Horsley digs into the numbers.
Erica Groshen used to run the bureau in the government that conducts the monthly jobs tally and calculates the inflation rate. After leaving the government, she served on an advisory committee that consulted on those and other key statistics until this week, when she got an email from the Commerce Department saying thanks, but her services were no longer needed.
Well, I was surprised, but not surprised.
The terse email and a note on the department's website say the advisory committee was disbanded because its purpose had been fulfilled. That puzzled Groshen, since she sees quality control as an ongoing process.
It is part of the mission of statistical agencies to be continually improving.
The message came just days after Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick suggested in a Fox News interview that he might change the way the government calculates GDP. Lutnick argued the change would present a more accurate picture of the economy, though it could also serve to mask negative effects of the Trump administration's spending cuts.
Governments historically have messed with GDP. They count government spending as part of GDP, so I'm going to separate those two and make it transparent.
Subtracting government spending from the formula would be a major break with long-standing practice and international standards. Erica Groshen says so far she hasn't seen any evidence of interference with the official government data, but she is on the lookout.
Statistical agencies live and die by trust. If the numbers aren't trustworthy, people won't use them to make important decisions, and then you might as well not publish them.
President Trump himself has frequently challenged the government's economic data, suggesting, for example, that job gains in the Obama administration were exaggerated. Trump is happy to take credit, though, when the numbers are in his favor, like the time his first press secretary, Sean Spicer, touted a rosy employment report.
Yeah, I talked to the president, and he said, to quote him very clearly, they may have been phony in the past, but it's very real now.
Even without any meddling, government number crunchers have their hands full. Fewer people are answering their surveys these days, and their budgets have steadily eroded. George Washington University professor Tara Sinclair is part of a group of business economists that works with the government data agencies.
They've been really working on a shoestring budget. Now they're facing additional concerns and uncertainty about what their budgets are going to be going forward. And they've already seen staffing losses, in part because of people taking what they call, you know, the fork emails.
Government data can move financial markets and a president's polling numbers. Erica Groshen says that could create a temptation for someone to try to cook the books,
either for political purposes or possibly even for financial gain.
Still, Groshen is confident that staffers at the government agencies would sound the alarm and probably resign if political people tried to doctor the data. She hopes that business people who count on the numbers to be reliable would also put up a fight.
I would hope the business and the financial communities would speak up loud and clear, and perhaps maybe they'll speak up now just to prevent it.
Taking the measure of this economy is not easy or free, but experts say losing the government's trustworthy data would be very costly. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Police in Toronto are searching for three suspects in a shooting at a pub last night. They say the men entered the pub and began firing randomly at customers with an assault-style rifle and handguns. 12 people were injured. Today is International Women's Day, observed around the world to honor women's achievements and to call for gender equality. Thousands of women are protesting in Turkey, accusing the government of not doing enough to stem violence against women. And a group called Stand Up for Science organized rallies across the country yesterday to protest the Trump administration's budget cuts, which it says could threaten science. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Next week marks 5 years since COVID-19 was declared a pandemic. Many people still live with the lasting consequences of catching the virus, also known as long COVID. NPR health correspondent Will Stone joins us now. Will, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure thing, Scott.
Long COVID can be debilitating for many people. Are scientists any closer to understanding it?
They are. Researchers have coalesced around a handful of explanations. There seem to be multiple underlying drivers of the illness, depending on the patient. One big focus has been the idea of viral persistence, that people never fully clear the infection. But there are others related to immune dysfunction, blood clots, the reactivation of other viruses. These could ultimately trigger symptoms like brain fog, like fatigue, shortness of breath, something called post-exertional malaise. The challenge here remains translating some of these insights into treatment. There are still no approved drugs for long COVID. The approach is often to manage symptoms and try to improve quality of life.
And what are the challenges in coming up with a treatment?
It comes down to clinical trials. There just aren't enough of them. A few years ago, there were a handful looking at drugs. Dr. Michael Peluso told me, by his count, there are now about 50, including some that Peluso is involved in at the University of California, San Francisco. But he says the reality is we just need a lot more for such a complex condition.
There are dozens of existing drugs that should be tested. We have drugs that can target almost every single one of the different mechanisms we think might be contributing to long COVID. But so far, we've launched way too few trials to actually do that with intense effort.
And Scott, one of the major barriers here is that drug makers are still on the sidelines to some extent. Over and over again, Peluso hears the reason is there's not a reliable biological measurement of the condition, a biomarker that can be tracked across multiple trials, in the same way that LDL or bad cholesterol is a biomarker for heart disease risk.
Do we know how many people are affected?
That's hard to pin down. Research, including CDC data, has found about 18 million adults in the U.S. had long COVID. There are more conservative estimates. All of this depends on how you're defining the condition, who you survey, and people are still getting long COVID. Here's what Hannah Davis told me. She has long COVID herself and co-founded an advocacy group called the Patient-Led Research Collaborative.
It has been downplayed. We've seen so much long COVID in the last year, 2 years. Long COVID rates, you know, have remained high in people who are vaccinated. It's remained high over different variants.
And I hear the same message from doctors who are seeing new patients alongside those who got sick 2, 3, 4 years ago and have not recovered.
What are you hearing from patients, Will? More resources, more funding?
Yeah, continually. The federal government has funded long COVID research through its RECOVER initiative. Last year, an additional $660 million was appropriated. That's to be spent over the next 4 years, including on clinical trials. Now, obviously, there's huge uncertainty about federal funding for scientific research in general under the Trump administration. I spoke to Megan Stone about this, no relation to me. She's a patient and directs the Long COVID campaign. Stone has been in D.C. lobbying senators and the administration to, among other things, protect those funds from any cuts. Actually, this past week, she was at the confirmation hearing for Trump's pick to lead the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, and she managed to get a moment with him afterwards.
he said to me, we're going to do the research to find a solution to this. I hope so. If the administration doesn't meet the patient community in that, then we will keep calling for action the same way that we did under President Biden. Regardless of party or political position, long COVID patients have been failed by our leaders.
To be clear, there's certainly skepticism about whether the administration will take this work seriously. And there are real disagreements between the patient community and those now leading federal health agencies around COVID policies more generally. But Stone says long COVID patients just don't have the luxury to sit this out over the next 4 years.
NPR health correspondent Will Stone, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And now it's time for sports. Lakers Celtics, the rivalry's back. 50,000 points for LeBron, and the Mavs continue to. Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, but boy, we got to begin with Nikola Jokic. His game last night, the Denver Nuggets star, the first ever 30-20-20 game, 31 points, 21 rebounds, 22 assists. Nuggets had to go into overtime to beat the Suns. This is extraordinary, isn't it?
No, he's great. Jokic, if you love watching basketball, I know people love to complain about how the game is played with too many three-pointers and it's essentially a shooting contest. But if you really love skill, he's a guy to watch night in and night out. He just does remarkable things, especially from the center position. The skill of these players is just off the charts, and he reminds you, for the old timers, he reminds you of Bill Walton, his passing ability, but also he can shoot with the best of them as well. And he's such an unselfish player, and every night you just don't know what he's gonna do. And he doesn't look like he's moving very quickly anyway, and he's still dominating the game. He's remarkable.
Greatest rivalry in basketball back on tonight. The Boston Celtics host the LA Lakers, as they might in the finals. The Lakers are scalding. They've won 8 in a row with their new star player, Luka Doncic, on the same team as a guy named LeBron. What are you going to be looking out for?
I'm going to be looking to see how the Celtics respond to this. They've already lost to the Lakers once before the Luka trade. They are the defending champions. They do not play well at home, and yet these are statement games. I know that it's a long season, and everybody has to get their rest and all the load management stuff. And you know, in an 82-game season, it's hard to say that anything is a signature game. But it's March now, and the Lakers made a blockbuster trade, and the Celtics are the defending champions. And this is when you start circling the games. Even when you're the player, you start saying to yourself, hey, we might see these guys in June. And so there's that. And then there's also the biggest thing. It's Lakers-Celtics. You're always supposed to get up for that, for those games. And even if you're a player and you've got a whole bunch of these things, for the fans, this is a game that everybody circles, and we want to see what the Celtics are going to do.
I also want to take a moment to acknowledge that this week LeBron James became the first 50,000-point player in NBA history. He entered the league when he was 18, Cleveland's own, playing for the Cavs straight out of high school, now 40, and still playing like one of the greatest ever.
Yeah, he is. There are no more superlatives for LeBron James. When he came into the league 22 years ago, believe it or not, I remember thinking he is the ultimate basketball player in terms of he's the most dominant physical specimen that's ever played the game. He's got the size to dominate his opponents the same way Shaq and Wilt did. He's got the speed of a guard. He's got the agility of a Michael Jordan. He's got the eyesight and the passing ability and the peripheral vision of a Magic and a Larry Bird. He can do it all, and he's also indestructible. If you look at to be 40 years old, and to usually your body tells you that it's time, and his body is unlike anything that we've seen in terms of his durability and his ability to stay healthy.
Look, I got to ask about the Dallas Mavericks, the team that traded away Luka Doncic for Anthony Davis, who's now injured. He'll miss the rest of the season. Kyrie Irving of the Mavericks tore his ACL. He'll miss the rest of the season. Do you think that next year their general manager, Nico Harrison, will be shouting, okay, who had the latte over here?
Next year, Nico Harrison, he might be in the stands watching. I mean, this is incredible in terms of, there's a reason why you don't get these trades very often in sports, Scott. And that's because if you're going to trade a player like Luka Doncic, your franchise guy, your signature guy, the guy that the fans pay money to see and who is easily one of the best five players in the NBA when he's right, you better be correct. You cannot get this wrong. And right now, this could not have gone worse for the Dallas Mavericks. In addition to everything going poorly for them, you get Anthony Davis is hurt, and then Kyrie Irving just tore his ACL. You trade him to the Lakers? And the hard thing is that they actually may be right in the long haul, but boy, this is looking like one of the worst trades in history.
Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much. Talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you.
Time now for StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, recording and sharing the stories of service members and their families. Today marks the 60th anniversary of the first U.S. combat troops arriving in Vietnam. Millions of American servicemen and women would do tours of duty there, including Army Specialist Henry Smithers.
It's not a day goes by that I don't think about it in some way or another. Even to now, it crosses my mind.
His daughter Roxanne brought him to StoryCorps. It was the first time he'd spoken with her about his experiences.
Where were you stationed when you went to Vietnam?
Da Nang. And at that point, we had about 350, 400,000 troops there. You look at the sea of men green, and the older ones telling tales, exaggerations. The younger ones frightened like you are. But then we flew into Quang Tri. It was 6 miles from North Vietnam. And we started taking fire. And now your reality sets in. You're here. And you're going to have to deal with it. And there's a lot of noise. Tremendous. I never heard so much noise. But after a while, it becomes a norm. You get used to it. But it was a hard time. Mainly because you think about home and you can't remember not one bad thing about home. Everything's good, the food's good, the people are good. And the year went by relatively fast, but the last 3 months, because near the end of your tour, you start to feel like you're not going to make it. Things are going to go wrong because you've seen too many things happen before.
What was it like coming home?
For one thing, it was so quiet. You get so used to choppers and fighter bombers, and then when you get home, it's like so quiet. So any noise, you know, it would startle you. And once I was driving, and the cop pulled up behind me, he wanted to know why I was going so slow. And I was just nervous, you know.
So what did you ultimately end up doing for a career?
Driving truck.
What did you like about it?
Being basically on my own. There was lots of Vietnam vets driving. I think it helped them, you know. But 33 years almost constantly moving. I know you guys wonder why I sit and watch TV all day. It just is a piece about being able to sit still, not worrying about the next load. I enjoy just being quiet, just being calm.
If you could think of one, you know, really important lesson that you feel like you've learned in your life, what would it be?
Patience. It's not as bad as it seems, and you'll really see the big picture later. I think most people, when you get older, you realize that lesson, that it's no real reason to be in a big hurry. Because when you're older, time slows you down.
Mm-hmm. So
most of your life is in your rearview mirror. So just slow down.
Army Specialist Henry Smithers and his daughter, Roxanne Smithers, for StoryCorps in Atlanta. After this interview, she took her father to visit the Vietnam Veterans Memorial for the first time, something he'd never felt ready to do before. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Yet another executive action from President Trump last night, this time an attempt to set limits on who qualifies for a longstanding federal student loan program. It's known as Public Service Loan Forgiveness. NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta is here to tell us. Thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Thanks.
Remind us what this program was designed to do.
Yeah, so it was signed into law in 2007 at the tail end of the George W. Bush administration. And what it set out to do is to provide relief for public servants who had taken out student loans. So if you worked for the government or a qualifying nonprofit organization, for example, and you spent 10 years working that job while also regularly making monthly loan payments, the federal government would come in and forgive the remaining balance as a kind of thank you for your service.
What does this executive action do?
So what it is attempting to do is to set limits on who actually qualifies for a PSLF, essentially saying if a borrower works for an organization whose activities have, quote, a substantial illegal purpose, they wouldn't qualify. And the order goes on to list a number of those activities, including violating federal immigration laws, supporting terrorism, engaging in what the order calls, quote, child abuse, and defines as including, quote, surgical castration or mutilation of children. It also lists aiding and abetting illegal discrimination and violating state laws like trespassing. I talked to Persis Yu, who's a legal expert at the Student Borrower Loan Center and advocacy group, and here's what she told me.
Debt is being used to scare hardworking public service workers from serving the most vulnerable members of our society or speaking out against the Trump administration's radical agenda.
Basically, she's saying this order is less about the loan forgiveness program itself and more about limiting the free speech of the people who work for certain kinds of organizations whose goals might not align with the Trump administration's agenda.
The Secretary of Education now is Linda McMahon. Has she said anything about this?
Not that I've seen since the order was issued last night, but she was actually asked about this very program at her confirmation hearing by Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine. Let's listen to their exchange.
So your commitment is, should you be confirmed, you will fully implement existing public service loan forgiveness programs that have been passed by Congress?
Those that have been passed by Congress, yes, that's the law.
So does this order have any immediate effect?
No. So that's the thing, Scott. PSLF is written into law, and existing borrowers have signed agreements with the Department of Education that say they qualify for the program. Now, the administration could re-regulate the law. The Biden administration actually did that in 2021 when they expanded the program. But they had to go through a lengthy federal rulemaking process to make that happen. And that's basically what would have to happen in this case. Persis, you told me she expects legal challenges to this executive order. So we'll wait and see.
And NPR's Janaki Mehta, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The White House is in a budget-cutting mindset. Mayors are worried about what that means for their cities.
Now is not the time to turn our back on seniors. Now is not the time to turn our back on veterans. Now is not the time to turn our back on our students.
Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb on federal spending policies and the impact of potential cuts. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Tropical Cyclone Alfred weakened today before reaching the east coast of Australia. It's now a tropical low and bringing heavy rain to millions of residents who are being urged to stay indoors. Officials say one man died in flooding in New South Wales. South Korea's impeached president was released from prison today. A court ruled yesterday that Yoon Suk-yeol could be free while he awaits trial. He's charged with rebellion for his attempt to declare martial law last year. And the Trump administration says it's ending the collective bargaining agreement for thousands of officers responsible for protecting the U.S. aviation system. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Karen Russell's sprawly new novel begins on a day called Black Sunday, set during the Dust Bowl storms in the 1930s. The story is told by Antonina Rossi.
On Black Sunday, before anybody knew to call it Black Sunday, I woke up in the jailhouse to a sound like a freight train tunneling through me, an ear-splitting howl that seemed to shake the stone walls. My body trembled like a husk on the cot, my fingers clawed into the mattress. For those early moments in the dark, I was nothing but the fear of floating off. What had happened to me while I slept? It felt as if a knife had scraped the marrow from my bones. Something vital inside me had liquefied and drained away. And in its place was this new weightlessness.
Karen Russell's new novel is called The Antidote, and the celebrated novelist and MacArthur Fellow joins us now from Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What's happening on this Sunday?
This Sunday begins ordinarily, you know, blue skies around 3 p.m. It looks like it's, you know, midnight. There are these apocalyptic clouds of dust that really swallow the sun. And sweep, you know, hundreds of tons of exposed fertile topsoil across the southern plains. They reach as far as D.C. You know, they famously dump on Congress. This was, you know, a stretch of time where these droughts and, you know, poor agricultural practices resulted in the dirt raining down, you know, from the heavens.
Tell us about Antonina, because she has a gift, if that's quite the way to phrase it, doesn't she?
She does. Antonina was sort of the beginning of this novel for me. I got an image when I was finishing my first novel, quite a long time ago now, of a woman holding an ear horn. They look sort of like gramophone horns, these antique hearing aids, while a man was whispering a secret to her and sort of leaving his consciousness and entering her body. So she has a gift for sort of swallowing the past and holding it in storage for people. Her baby was taken from her at a home for unwed mothers. And this loss, and you know, in this novel, it sort of dynamites a space inside her that she is renting out as storage for the memories that people can't stand to remember or bear to forget.
She puts them in a vault of her subconscious, doesn't she?
Yes, exactly. They're sort of beyond the waterline of her waking consciousness. She herself doesn't even know, you know, what these people are whispering to her. And they can come and make withdrawals, too. You know, they read their deposits, slip backwards, and it leaves her and reenters them. But she says, you know, just like a vault, she doesn't know what she contains. On the Black Sunday referenced, she sort of wakes up in that jailhouse to that terrible weightlessness. Everything she's stored for this town for 15 years has been whisked out of her body.
There's a photographer who's dispatched to capture the crisis. Her camera has what I'll call a special sight.
There's a photographer. She's not, you know, she's fictional. Her name is Cleo Alfrey, and she's sent really to document rural poverty. And with this camera that has special sight, she starts to take pictures that feel inexplicable of things that seem to be happening on a piece of ground, you know, maybe yesterday, maybe 500 years in the past, maybe in some hypothetical future.
Her photographs disclose the fact that people were there before people we call immigrants ever got there.
Yes. So some of the photographs are showing that long before Europeans come to this region, there are other communities, the dozens of Native nations that have been successfully living on and with this prairie ecosystem for millennia. And so some of what she's seeing is sort of a past world of flourishing. And then she's also sort of able to conjure both hell worlds, but also, you know, blue skies, places where buffalo are kind of migrating out of the past and into the future. And that felt important to me. One of the inspirations for Cleo's character, you know, I learned a lot from Gordon Parks and his books.
Gordon Parks, the great photographer, yes.
You know, he said two things that really struck me. And one was, I saw that the camera could be a weapon against poverty, against racism, against all sorts of social wrongs. I knew at that point I had to have a camera. And I found myself with this particular camera with its unique long range. You know, we have these things installed in us in birth, and there are imaginations, and we can do this incredible thing, conjuring these future worlds that maybe they don't exist today, but they could, and making those real. And right now, I think it's really easy for a lot of us to extrapolate from what's happening today to a really bleak vision of tomorrow. And so I think part of what I try to do in this book is use my imagination to draw other kinds of worlds into focus.
Well, you have a discussion between a couple of locals at one point, and somebody says, it's a shame, but it's over and done with.
Right. And I mean, if there's anything that this novel taught me, it's that the past is certainly not safely in the past, right? Mm-hmm. That it really cohabits with the present and continues to shape it. And I really wanted, as I mentioned, to try to envision a future that was not apocalyptic, right? A future mm-hmm. world that felt more just and more peaceful, you know, with shared abundance for all. And to do that, I think we can't do that unless we return to our nation's history and try to reckon with it.
In life, isn't a certain amount of strategic forgetting the antidote, if you please, to just going on?
Yes. I mean, it's humbling to write a book about the gaps in people's memories while I'm very aware of many in my own, Scott, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can hold the entire secret cargo we each carry. It can't always be present to us, right? And certainly this book isn't a full 360, right? It's not so much about like filling in all the holes as sort of illuminating what possibilities and responsibilities we might be missing.
Karen Russell, her new novel, The Antidote. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
They say everything's bigger in Texas. Now one man wants everything to include a 1,500-mile walking trail.
We like to think that we're rebooting Texas here. We're getting people back out into the dirt because in that is learning. In that is slowing down, getting out of reach of the cell phones. There is some magic in that, and that's what we're creating.
Later today in All Things Considered, meet Charlie Gandy, the man with a big dream to create the X-Tex Trail for biking, hiking, and horseback riding. Yeehaw, saddle up and listen in. Turn on your radio and tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. It's been 60 years since the historic Civil Rights March in Selma, Alabama. Protesters demanded equal voting rights for African Americans. State troopers met those calls with shocking violence. That confrontation and that city gave birth to the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Today, there's new generations of civil rights activists in Selma, and they're still facing many of the problems those marchers sought to highlight six decades ago: segregation, poverty, and gun violence. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
Riding through town, it's evident Selma has seen better days. The downtown YMCA building is boarded up. On some streets, houses appear to be abandoned and falling in. Mark Miles grew up here, and he's taking me to a school where he does violence intervention work.
We're going to make this left right here.
Left?
Yes, ma'am.
Miles is with the Selma Center for Nonviolence, Truth, and Reconciliation. The nonprofit is trying to build on the legacy started here 60 years ago when peaceful voting rights marchers faced off with violent state troopers on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge. Miles says given the history here, Selma should be a model city for race relations. But it's not.
It just feel like we're going back into the 60s. So it kind of reminds me of what our forefathers fought for and the sacrifices they made, that it's time for us as a younger generation to make those same sacrifices. I just think it's our time to stand up.
We're headed for Elwood Christian Academy, a private school that takes in students who are not thriving in Selma's public schools, which he says are more segregated than ever.
Black kids never talk to white kids, and white kids never talk to black kids. They're going to believe the worst thing about each other because they've never communicated.
Miles, who is 42, says he spent much of his youth in trouble and was incarcerated in his teens. Now he's trying to give students the tools to better navigate life in Selma.
How you doing, students? How y'all doing today?
Good.
He circles up about a half dozen students, and it doesn't take long for them to turn the conversation to the violence that surrounds them. Skyla Withers is just 12 years old, but carries a hefty grief.
Selma, it's a lot of young people dying at a young age. Make me feel sad because they closer to my age.
People don't fight with their hands anymore, she says, but pick up a gun to settle differences. She describes a life on edge, trying not to get caught up in the gun violence plaguing this city.
It's hard when you just can't lay your head down and have a peaceful night without hearing gunshots. When you hear the gunshots, you know who the person is. You're like a minute later, you go on social media, you see who the person is after hearing the gunshots.
On Valentine's weekend, for instance, a 14-year-old was shot to death. And in January, an innocent bystander was killed in a shootout in the Walmart parking lot. Among those charged are two teenagers. 14-year-old Carmesia Spivey says it's no way to live.
People feel so scared to go outside their own house because as soon as you go outside, you could get a bullet right to your head and you wouldn't even know who it's from.
Selma is a majority black city with about 17,000 people. It's lost more than 10,000 residents since the civil rights era, driven in part by white flight. There's not a lot of industry here, other than a paper mill on the outskirts of town. Most of the jobs are in healthcare, government, or the service industry. And the town is still trying to recover from a destructive tornado 2 years ago. For students like 16-year-old Joshua Peoples, the outlook is bleak.
It's just sad seeing how Selma is right now. Like, I just don't like it right now. Like, living in Selma is just, man, it's horrible. It's terrible.
When the conversation turns to what happened in Selma 60 years ago, several students don't really know the history. Some who do have a cynical view, asking what good was it for people to risk that bridge crossing for black freedom when young black people are killing one another in Selma today. Kamora Fletcher is 12.
I honestly, sometimes I sit down and think that it was a waste because now there's gun violence, gangs, the lack of education about our history. I honestly feel like they wasted their time, but I feel like we need a fresh new start.
If you were the mayor, what would you do if you could create a new Selma? What would Selma be?
We need a lot more places for our kids to go and more grocery stores.
I would like to see arcades here in Selma. I feel like kids need to learn how to have fun, have positive.
Honestly, I believe that we need more educators, you know, in Selma, Alabama. We need people that actually want to help our community, actually teach us about our history. Black people should not be fighting against each other. We should join each other in brotherhood and sisterhood, you know, as one race.
My vision of a new Selma is like getting guns and drugs and stuff off the streets.
The voices of Skyla Withers, Joshua Peoples, Kamora Fletcher, and Abril Johnson.
My encouragement to them is get in the fight now.
That's Lydia Chapman, Director of Programs at the Selma Center for Nonviolence. From the 1865 Battle of Selma at the end of the Civil War to the 1965 voting rights battle, she says Selma has always been at the center of change.
We have been a pivotal place when it comes to thinking about race relations and relationships in general for hundreds of years. And today the fight is trying to make sure that it's not 2065 when reckoning happens again.
Chapman, who has a teenage son, says she doesn't want to see every future generation in Selma and the country have to fight.
We really have got to do this in a better, smarter way to make sure that the changes that need to be in place are done in a way that they are sustainable and long-lasting.
Her focus has been on economic development. More than one in four people here live in poverty. Chapman says it's been heart-wrenching to see what's happened to her hometown, but she holds on to the promise of the future. Back at Elwood Christian, Mark Miles wraps up his session trying to empower the students.
How many voices we got to hear? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we can change the city, y'all. But you guys have to believe. And I want you guys to continue to use your voice and dream of a better Selma and try to be a part of that change.
Joshua Peoples is ready.
We got to be the inspiration, the big change. As one, we got to stand up for who we are and what we got to do to make Selma a much better place.
There we go. I like that. Make Selma great again.
Yeah, that could be our motto.
1, 2, 3.
Make Selma great again!
This weekend, as Selma celebrates 60 years since it gave America equal voting rights, its complicated past informs the challenges for this new generation. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Selma, Alabama.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
From